Hello everybody and welcome to episode 23 of Here We Go Again, Israeli Politics. Facebook under investigation for harmful content and Netflix puts up anti-Israel content. Sexual harassment claims have been levied against three prominent people and the political reactions are astonishing. Yuli Edelstein has announced he will be running for the head of the Likud. Is Netanyahu done for? And our borders may be just open wide for all sorts of terrorists to come. This is Here We Go Again. And for our first topic.
So, as many of you well know, there is a leak coming out of Facebook. There was a whistleblower who went in front of Congress to discuss the fact that Facebook's algorithm and their contacts hurt children and teens. As a result, the Minister of Communications, Yoaz Hindel, has opened up a committee in Israel stating with a quote-unquote wide mandate, which is going in 90 days, to look at the option of putting sanctions on Facebook and forcing them to take the burden of legal burden of anything said on their platform. Essentially removing the Israeli version of Section 230, which states that they are a hosting platform and therefore not liable for anything stated by others on their program. They will essentially force Facebook to censor and police facts however they see fit on their program. This is obviously a very dumb move, very, very dumb political move, for the simple reason that the only people this is going to force to be censored is the right. As we've seen in every place in the world, social media veers to the left. There are usually left-wing proponents that work in social media. And as a result, the right gets censored. And if you, the quasi-right-wing person in this government, are forcing Facebook to censure, they'll happily come and censor all of the people on the app and essentially remove right-wing politicians for not stating facts accurately or putting content that might lead to harm or things like that. And as a result, it's just a very bad look for a right-wing and will lead to disastrous consequences. As usual, Israeli politicians are not taking into account long-term effects. They only see the short-term game of maybe a populist thing of Facebook, it looks bad right now, and therefore they need to act. And they need to know that this will come to bite them in the ass one day.
Okay, but doesn't that mean that practically we'll be able to hold Facebook accountable for things that are done on the left? Just because they target it, I don't understand why this will not help us target Facebook when the left does things that are equal to the right and they're not being taken care of.
Because even in the proposal that they're suggesting that they want to look into, it would be Facebook's own team that would decide what needed to be censored based on things that they said. They would have to form a committee that decided what would be right or wrong. And either way, no, we don't want to censor speech. Censoring speech on a platform is bad. Essentially, all of the new social media apps have become the new town square. They've become the new market of information. You should be able to spread whatever information you deem necessary, you deem vital to your political movement on whatever platform you wish, because these platforms are just hosting you. They are not the ones writing this information. They're not a newspaper. They have no editorial board. But once they decide that they start censoring, then maybe they should be stripped of their power and all censoring should be held liable. Currently, when they don't censor people, they shouldn't be held liable because they're just a hosting platform.
Okay, but
it's
what
essentially
do you say
someone
about
putting an advertisement on a bulletin board in the roads.
I understand, but what do you say about the idea that, you know, they're trying to censor the fake news about the vaccines or about any other thing that's endangering people? Now, I want to be very careful with my question here. I'm not specifying the question of whether or not the vaccines and the overall complications I'm saying, but if there's really basic things that are accepted upon that are science and that are endangering people, then either the people have to be held responsible for posting it or Facebook has to be held responsible. But if I post a post about, you know, if you want to make a special yummy soda, you mix these two chemicals together and those two chemicals will kill you, then someone has to be responsible for that.
The person is held responsible. It's the same idea that if I run a medical ad on the news, I say, I run a medical ad stating that this and this is a great new program for weight loss, and then essentially it kills you, then you should be held accountable. The person who suggested the idea, he is held accountable for the same reason we currently have laws on the books in Israel for libel. And if someone posts something online, they happen to be too strict in my opinion, but that's irrelevant. They have laws for libel on the books. If I post something online slandering you, then yes, you can hold me accountable. You're not holding Facebook or Instagram or Twitter accountable for what I posted on their platform. But there is another side to this coin. And that is what happened this week with Netflix. For those who are not aware, Netflix opened up a new category this week, and it's called Middle East category. Obviously, this Middle East category is completely anti-Israel. There are 32 movies in this new Middle East category, and all of them have star something along the lines of the plots of Palestinian family ripped apart by the Six-Day War, attempts to find itself through a harsh Israeli environment, or Palestinian film crew stopped at a border crossing, and what happened next will surprise you. Many, many movies like these, which are all titled under Middle Eastern, which are all anti-Israel movies. They are all pro-Palestinian, anti-Israel movies. Now, to be clear, the government does not have the authority, nor should it, to censor these movies, because they're simple movies, they're not a statement of fact, they're not a statement of history. And however, from a political movement standpoint, from a social standpoint, this should be censored, this should be stopped. What does that mean? When looking at the essential facts of our society, society holds a lot of power. And as a result, yes, politicians should call for Netflix to take these down. Different members of the community should call for these to be taken down. The community still holds a lot of power. Whilst in the States it has been called cancel culture or McCarthyism, it did play an important role throughout history that it was needed. And the society had its own rules without the government stepping in to censor certain products. Netflix is not like Facebook in this scenario because Netflix is the one creating the content, or really perpetrating it, whilst they're not just hosting the content of other creators.
So I believe that when it comes to, and when I say cancel culture, I don't want to get into the American politics of the matter because that's a whole large topic. But some part of it is I believe that that's connected the way their free market works. I do not have a problem with the fact that the populists come and they come out and say that we believe this should be done and therefore this influences public policy or influences companies. That's a good thing in my opinion. That's exactly how you let the people make effect on change. With that cannot equal ever into a legal question. For example, if I have a contract with you and then you must obey that contract, whether or not I'm suddenly canceled, whether or not the culture decided they're against what I'm doing, you have a contract you have to obey. And if I breach that concept, I legally have the obligation to uphold every piece of that contract. Now, that is exactly a decision a company will have to make and make the decision. I'm talking about even when there's something that I support, the populace coming in attacking it. And if I support it when it comes to Netflix, it still should have to be, there should be, every contract should have to be upheld. And each company has to make a decision on how he wants to act.
Yes, but even culturally, it is once again important to pay attention to the inherent distinction between Facebook and Netflix here, because Facebook is just hosting whilst Netflix is creating the content here. And Facebook should not be held accountable to it. Our next topic is a sexual harassment claim. A sexual harassment claim was purportedly hidden by Minister Elazar Shtern when he was a high-ranking official in the army. This is essentially a claim that years ago, a soldier in Ba'ad Echad, which is the officers' training school in the army, was essentially sexually harassed, and he hid this effect and covered it up completely. It caused a huge uproar in the government because Elazar Shtern, the minister Elazar Shtern from the Yesh Atid party, was currently being nominated for the head of the Jewish agency position. The Jewish agency position is a very important and very powerful position, which the current president of Israel previously held. His position is also very important because he currently has a ministerial position which needed to be opened up to satisfy a member of the government who is not too happy and was just considering leaving this government and essentially breaking it apart. Now back to the claims. The fact that he has been accused of sexual harassment and he's of the left caused a very big issue because the Me Too movement and Believe All Women was very prevalent in these areas. This also claim in a time when a sexual harassment claim was levied against the late President Shimon Peres, that during his tenure as president and as the foreign minister, he hurt a woman named Colette Avital, and that he assaulted her on numerous occasions. This is only coming out now because Peres, they claim, held an immense amount of power and influence, and it only came out many years later now because that they're trying to cover this up. There was many reactions from the members of this government. For example, Minister Merav Micheli, the head of the Labor Party, wrote that sexual assault is always on the table with us. We are discussing it. We believe all women always. We believe that Shimon Peres did what he did to her. And we also believe the things that were said about Minister Stern. She stated that she always believes the ones of the victims, and it's hard for me to hear and look at men who do these types of things. And this must this must be dealt with. And eventually, it was forced It was forced for him to rescind his appointment and his nomination to this position. Now, before we get to the actual facts of this case, it is once again, of course, absurd, just the concept of believe all women, because the answer should have been an investigation. These are claims that were made without substantial evidence. There may be substantial evidence. They may be completely right. We are not discussing whether they're right or not. The fact of the believe all women stance led to serious hypocrisy, because Elazar Stern, essentially, his life was ruined at this point, but it wasn't really, because he apologized. He said, I'm sorry that anyone has the pretense that I did anything or that I hurt anyone, and that if this happened, which it didn't, I'm sorry. But he's staying a minister. If he couldn't be appointed to the Jewish agency because of this, why could he stay a minister? Why was this a legitimate option for this? It was all just hypocrisy. And it was such hypocrisy that Gandhi, who was a prominent member of the right in Israel years ago, was murdered. He was murdered, and a few years after his murder, sexual assault allegations were levied against him. As a result, the left-wing parties of the government at the time had blocked street namings or any commemoration of him. And it seems very hypocritical that these same left-wing parties and these same politicians in many cases were now allowing commemoration of the late president Shimon Peres whilst they destroy the memory of Gandhi. For example, the MK, Michal Rosin from the Meretz party, said she decided to attempt to explain her stance by saying, we did not destroy Gandhi's memory only because of his sexual harassment and rape allegations, but because of his stances and character. We will not ostracize the memory of Shimon Peres. The witness of Avital hurts us and hurts his memory deeply, but we must never remember what he did for the good of the country and his correct stances. Meaning, if you have the correct political viewpoint, everything you do is fine. You will be remembered forever as a saint who saved the country, no matter what you actually did. The question is, do you have the correct political viewpoints or not? And this is a terrible thing for any member of the government, right, or any member of politics in general, right or left, to say. It just destroys our culture.
So I have so much to say on this matter. This matter really heated me up, and it was a very, very difficult week. Let's start with one thing that we have to put out there and make very clear. Sexual harassment is horrible, it's terrible, and it should be prosecuted to the utmost strictness in the law. And so this is something I need to put out straightforward before I continue to make that very clear to all our listeners. With that, there is a way that things work. And this just showed how deep and corrupt the system is. The system that's supposed to protect these women, how corrupt and political it is. And they were completely, completely hypocritical in this situation. You know, one of the claims that I always come and make is a couple things. I say, first of all, as Binyamin mentioned moments ago, there is a legal procedure that goes through. The only procedure in almost any other topic that we just decide to completely just decide the person's guilty immediately is only in this situation. Okay? Even more extreme situation. If literally someone is accused of murder, everyone will still agree. Okay, if he denies it, then we will go to court. he will be either guilty or innocent, and then we will move on. And if he is innocent, then he can go back to his life because he is not guilty of this murder. When it comes to these situations, time and time again, you just need someone to come up, make a claim. Again, whether or not true or false, I'm not lowering it. If the claim is true, then as again you mentioned, then the person should have to be prosecuted for that. But that is once you have the claim is true. That's the first of all. And then you see their reaction of them people that they completely just make the statement of, wait, he did a lot of great things, but he only did something wrong. I agree with that claim. I've made this claim many times before. Again, not defending the act, but it's the same as if someone came and did another violent crime. Again, I'm not comparing. Each crime is separate, and each person that is hurt is different, and that's why there are also different laws for each crime. But this does not deny all the other great things that someone did. I agree with that statement. I just think that statement should have been true regarding many other politicians in the past that were with different political views.
As we stated, essentially the rules have to be constant. And the rules should be different because when you are discussing such things as sexual harassment, believe all women, not just hurts men because they are essentially ostracized from the moment the claim is made, it hurts women because the perception in people's mind is she's lying. She's not telling the truth because she's just doing this for money, power, fame, whatever. Or she's doing this to ruin his life, revenge. No, it should simply be facts, case, law. We will research something, we will get to the bottom of this, and if you're right, we will get you justice. That should always be the statement. And the blatant hypocrisy presented by the left here is just disgusting. And to be clear, if this is true, then yes, the Minister Stern should resign. And if this isn't true, then he should get his appointment back. And to be clear, I also agree with what you said on the fact that a person can be remembered for the good things whilst remembering the bads. Yes, many of the American founding fathers kept slaves. Yes, was that horrible? Were they also great people? Yes. Many of the Israeli politicians at the beginning of the country did horrible acts to their political adversaries. Did they also fight for this country and do amazing acts? Yes. And as we discussed early in the episode with Netflix and Facebook, we have to notice that not everything is just policy-wise. There is also something of a culture being created. And especially when discussing rape culture or sexual harassment or anything of this nature, we must be very careful in what we do and what precedent we set, because the culture will eventually come back to affect the policy. The policy affects the culture, and the culture affects the policy. And they're interconnected, and when just stating we believe all women, then the policy will eventually hurt all women and all men in an equal manner, because you must always know that the culture you're espousing, even if it helps you politically, must be something good and inherent which can later somehow face a policy standpoint.
So I think that one more factor is that just disturbs me personally is a matter of timing. And this is something that's happened in America as well, but is definitely happening here. You know, Elazar Stern, let me be clear for those listeners, I do not like the man. I don't like him as a politician, I don't like his views, and I would more than love for him to not be chosen for the Knesset next round. Legally, okay? Democratically, okay? I want him to be voted out of the Knesset. But, so let me start with that. With that, I do not accept the claim that suddenly this issue became opened up. Okay? There's either two options for when a certain thing could happen. This either can happen immediately when someone becomes in the public sector, which in that case I can accept that, as in, you know, this person did something to you X years ago, either you didn't know where he was, you never saw him, or you know what, he really just didn't affect your life anymore, you didn't want to deal with it, and he has his own family, and then the second he became in the public sector, you said, wait, I need to make this clear to the people here because he should not be chosen for public sector. Okay, that's a legitimate time you decided to make that change. Or, and you know what, on the other hand, if we're talking about Shimon Peres, assuming this claim is true, then I can accept that as well. Once the person passed away, this person, I believe them, that they could have been fearful of Shimon Peres' power. And to those who don't know that are listening, Shimon Peres basically was in power the entire time this country exists. Okay, from the Declaration of Independence of Yom HaAtzmaut till the day he died, he was in different positions of power. And therefore, once he passed away, now she felt comfortable and safe to come out and make her claims. I can accept that. I cannot accept that suddenly Elazar Stern has been a high-up general, he's been a Knesset member, and he's been a minister. Nothing. Suddenly he's nominating for a certain position, and then these claims pop up out of nowhere? I don't accept that. Again, not claiming that the claims aren't true. I'm claiming that the timing is unacceptable, and I'm claiming that I have a feeling that these claims are being pressured by other political figures, and that's my problem.
That's a perfect segue, because what are those political figures? As we mentioned, Eli Stern was supposed to be a nominee to a very important position, the head of the Jewish agency. But that is the less important part of the story. The more important part is what position he was freeing. He was freeing a ministerial position, which Eli Avidal, who is the member of Lieberman's party, who has been increasingly agitated and unhappy with this government and his position in this government since its formation, and who has threatened to leave many times if he doesn't receive a ministerial position, he needed that seat opened up so he can come and get that seat. Now, is this the reasoning for the sexual harassment? I have no idea, and that's irrelevant. It's just the timing of this and the weakness that it formed in this government is incredibly suspicious and raises the doubts that many people have on this topic.
Okay, for our next topic.
It finally happened. The Likud fractured. We have been debating since the formation of this government, what would come first? Would this government fall apart, or would the Likud fracture into itself? And it appears to be that the Likud is finally fractured. What are we talking about? What happened? So, Yuri Edelstein, the previous Minister of Health, the previous Speaker of the House of Israel, Bibi's right-hand man, has officially announced that he will be running for the head of the Likud. What effect does this have on the Likud? Will there be primaries? Are other people going to run? All of this will be discussed in a moment. First, let's get down to what happened. First, he came out with this announcement with an interview with Amit Segal, stating that first, anytime there has been an announcement since the formation of this government that people in the Likud have said stuff, it has been from him. And he has announced that he is running for the head of the Likud against Netanyahu because he believes that with Netanyahu, they will always stay in the opposition. Okay? He has stated four times they tried with Netanyahu. Why should we succeed a fifth time? We don't need to, Edelstein is stating, there doesn't even need to be elections. There are 70 right-wing mandates in this government. If he is the head of the Likud, he can create a government today that would replace the current government. He's saying it is time to change the method that the Likud works. Netanyahu was a great prime minister, but he cannot get elected anymore. It's or me or this dangerous left-wing government led by Lapid and Meretz and Ram. He's saying that with him, there will not be a singular person in charge. It will be the party will lead. And he said that no matter what happens, he will not leave the Likud. And he hopes that the other nominees will support this as well and announce this. He stated that he was not behind Netanyahu when Netanyahu opened his court case because he did not believe in his, he didn't need to prove his faithfulness to the leader, to Big Brother. He said that there is a difference in kind between them. He fights for an ideal, not for a person. He fought for the separation of powers. Remember, he did have a big fight with the Supreme Courts at this time. He's saying no elections does Netanyahu get to 61, but but he does. He says, but even if they go to elections, then he still gets it. Now, why is this important to him? Why does he keep on emphasizing 61? Okay. Obviously, let's say he wins. Let's say he becomes the head of the Likud. In the polls, the Likud drops considerably. Okay. For example, in a poll that came out the following day, it stated that the Likud would drop to 20 mandates. The mandates go to the rest of the right-wing parties, to Shas, to Smutlitz, and so on. However, okay, if you wanted to do a serious right-wing government in that constellation, you could do it with 63 mandates. Or center-right, you could do it with 71. And that's the serious question. His argument is going to be, we don't need a massive amount of mandates for our party. The question is the 61. Can we form a government or not? And his claim that he can form a government is correct. His only issue is going to be that there is no primaries in the Likud. And that's where his timing comes in. Before we get to his timing and the issue of primaries of the Likud, let's see the reaction of some of the more prominent members of the Likud. Okay, so the first member that reacted is the M.K. Mickey Zohar, who espews much and is usually a very loud and vocal player in the Likud, although not necessarily a very powerful one. He stated that the Likud is a democratic movement, maybe the only one in the political map today. Anyone who wants to can openly run, but we will continue to promote Benjamin Netanyahu and hopefully that that he wins any nominee. Dr. Shlomo Kerry, also from the Likud, he stated he had much harder things to say. He said, you were looking who is the next person to go break apart into this thievery government. You got it. So, in the middle of a war on anti-Zionism, we have wars within our government with almost no support. He's going left like all the losers before him. And so on and so forth. Chaim Katz stated that there will not be primaries in the Likud before the Knesset is dispersed. Now, can primaries be forced? Very interesting question. The Likud has its own court and its own formal system of deciding these things. The essential answer is not by Yuli alone. He needs a massive participant of the Likud to force this. That's where his timing comes in. He did it very early, essentially stating that when he does this, first of all, anyone else who announces will be connotations automatically to him. Everyone remember that he announced first. Also, he forces everyone else into the corner. There are still a lot of powerful members of the Likud that need to make a decision if they're going to run or not. Be it Gilad Erdan, who's currently still in the States in a position of being the foreign ambassador to the UN, or you have Nir Barkat, who has been slighted by Bibi many, many times, and who holds a lot of sway in the Likud themselves. We already saw some of the other players. You have Miri Regev. There are many, many powerful players in the Likud which need to make their own decisions on whether or not they're going to run. And if many of them decide to run or support him themselves, okay, then they will automatically get, can force a primaries onto Netanyahu, which will be a very interesting thing to see. Netanyahu himself has yet to state if there will be primaries or not, and he has yet to react. He's most likely testing the waters to see maybe if no one else is announcing, then maybe it's a good time to run primaries, and he'll crush Yuli Edelstein. Now, how do we know he'll crush Yuli Edelstein? Because, for a very simple reason, in polls stating it, Netanyahu wins 68% to 17%. And with a 15% which are undecided. These are very serious polls, very bad for Yuli. But Yuli still has a lot of time ahead of him to convince the public, stating the question is not me or Netanyahu running for the head of the government. The question is, I'm with the government, Netanyahu in the opposition. And he did it very important timing because there's exactly less than a month left until the budget in this government has to be passed. And if he can show that he has a government outside of this government, that he can push the right members of this government, the right-wing members of this government, to let the budget fall. Let this budget fall and him pick up the pieces and build a new future. He's timing it well to force everyone to act quickly. Because if people don't act quickly, then they can be blamed later on for the fact that a budget passed. He was also very careful throughout this, we might note, to never ever slight Netanyahu. He never said a bad word about him. He only stated that it was no longer possible to form a government with his leadership, which is very important for the members of the Likud, which he's trying to gain their favor.
So it's the main thing that's interesting here, and he pulled a move which I personally don't think he's going to succeed in, but it's a very interesting take he was saying. Throughout the entire way, he never said it's me against Bibi. He never even tried to claim he's going up against Bibi because he knows Bibi will beat him. His idea was, which was really, really brilliant, if you think about it, he was saying, not just to make him more active, he wasn't saying it's either me as Prime Minister or Bibi in the opposition. He wasn't even mentioning Bibi. He's saying it's either me as Prime Minister or it's Yair Lapid as Prime Minister, which you know what is true. His claim is not right now. He says, what happens in, what is it, less than 2 years already, a year and a half from now? He says, what happens then? At that point right now, Yair Lapid becomes Prime Minister. Now, Bibi is definitely not going to be Prime Minister a year and a half because that's the only thing that's holding this whole government together. He says, so even if you think Bibi's better than me, that's fine. I agree with you. Bibi's great. He was a great Prime Minister. This is what Yuli Edelstein is saying. But factually, he cannot form a government. This government thing, which means that in a year and a half, Yair Lapid is going to become prime minister. Unless he is replaced by someone else, even if it's less powerful. Even if he brings 20 seats instead of 30, Yuli Edelstein can form a government and do it before Yair Lapid even becomes prime minister. Because the second the switch is about to happen, Bennett loses his spot anyway. Anyone under Bennett is handing Yair Lapid the government. If Yuli Edelstein could offer them a government not under Bibi, it can happen. All of what he's saying is true. The question is, can he transform that into votes?
And on a more important note, it's also his biggest argument stating elections are not needed. He say, even if the Likud were fall to 20 mandates with me, I don't need to go to elections. I can use the 30-odd mandate that we have now without going to elections. All is needed is a primary where he becomes the prime minister.
Now, to your question of whether or not this is fracturing the Likud, I think yes and no, okay? Do I think that this is specifically fracturing the Likud? No. I don't believe that Yuli is a powerful enough member. He's a very powerful member, and he's constantly number one or two. But he does not have enough to sway the entire party and within the party itself. With that, it's the beginning of the downfall, okay? This is the thing that slowly will move another politician, another prophet politician to move it. Definitely we're moving towards the budget. We'll see less and less mentioning of Bibi and more fracturing in the party.
And we'll probably see more and more players, for example, Bakat, as we mentioned, and others that may end up taking their place is saying that they're running. They're all waiting to see what Netanyahu's response is going to be on whether or not they're going to run. Is this a fracturing of the Likud? It's hard to say simply because that Yuli was very careful. Yuli stated numerous times he will not leave the Likud no matter what happens, unlike others that ran, failed, and then left. He is staying a integral part of this party, unlike others before him, and that will be an interesting thing to see, and we'll continue to update you as this goes along with this scenario. Now, on to the effects on this government. Everyone has their eyes towards this government with a look at the budget, but there are many other things this past week which have led to serious issues within this government, and we have a few things in the coming week which we know will lead to drastic consequences for this government if they're not dealt with quickly. The two biggest issues that this government faced this week was, one, the law for legalizing the medical use of marijuana, which passed in the Knesset with Arabs voting for it after intense pressure from the New Hope Party. And an immigration law. There was a base law suggested, we discussed this in the past, called Chok Yesod HaHagira, the base law of immigration, which would essentially establish how immigration is handled in this country. Because for the past 18 years, immigration has been handled in this country essentially by a continuing resolution. Each year, a new resolution had to be passed, the same statement every year, which was a extenuating circumstances that we need to deal with, and therefore people from the Gaza and from Judea and Samaria who are marrying into this country cannot become because they're members of enemy states. That being stated, okay, that will essentially be no longer in place very, very soon. Okay, that law will no longer be in place because the year have been up since it has been passed the previous time. So, there were many, many talks between the opposition and the coalition to attempt to get it passed or something different passed. And it was finally suggested that base law for immigration would be put forward to attempt to deal with this. It was put forward by M.K. Simcha Rothman, who was the one dealing with this with Minister Ayelet Shaked, who is the Minister of the Interior. But it broke apart completely. He stated, Simcha Rothman stated, I went into the into negotiations table with the express intention of protecting the borders of the state of Israel, and I was disappointed. In the moment of truth, Ayelet Shaked chose to stay obligated to Abbas, who is the head of the Arab party, and Tolovitz, who is the head of the left-wing Meretz party, and she refused to go back on her dangerous promises to them. Okay, he then later announced that the base immigration law would go up to a vote in the Knesset on Wednesday after all of the negotiations fell apart. Just to clarify, that law fell and did not pass, with many of the authors of that original bill voting against it for political purposes. For example, members of the New Hope Party and members of Yamina specifically Ayelet Shaked. Okay? From Ayelet Shaked, she refused MK Rothman's suggestion to pass the base immigration law, stating that it would, first of all, would not solve the issue at hand because it would require more legislation to solve the issue at hand, and that she simply wants, this is not a time to shake things up, and this is simply the time to pass the same thing we've been passing for the past 19 years. Okay? Now, for a very clear thing, everyone is wrong. Many things can be right at once. From the government's standpoint, this is not the time to be changing things up. Okay? You, from the opposition, are attempting to do this base immigration law, but I'm sorry, you never got the government. You don't get to play, you don't get to try to change things on the ground, and you're only doing it to try to hurt the government. Okay? From the other standpoint, yes, everyone needs to sit down and deal with this issue, because there is a massive thousands, if not tens of thousands, of people waiting for immigration, essentially dangerous people who this may very well affect, and they need to deal with it. The simple answer is everyone's wrong. Everyone needed to sit down and compromise. And I'm sorry to this government. We have many times in the past defended this government. I cannot defend this government on this. You cannot support the. You cannot expect the opposition to support a law, even if that law, they should be supporting it in theory, because it's a law that everyone supports. Your own government should have to pass it on its own. That means, yes, merits the left-wing part of this government and the Arabs. If you are a member of a government with them, then yes, they have to vote for it. You cannot expect help from the opposition. You cannot demand it. That being said, the opposition should have it, when it becomes the last, you're at the last day of this, yes, you need to come together and vote for this bill to pass no matter what happens.
And with that, we will move on to the dumb economic decisions of the week.
Members of both the left and people who call themselves right-wing parties, both coalition and opposition, have come out in support of a law for a hike in the minimum wage to 40 shekel. Okay? For those who are wondering who these so-called members of the right are, to be clear, they're a member of the center-to-center, right? They're a member of the supposed right-wing Likud party. This is Ofir Katz, who is a member of parliament from the Likud, who has stated his support, come out publicly, and even signed the proposal of the bill to raise the minimum wage to 40 shekel an hour. Essentially, a terrible economic move, which can lead to unemployment and a rise in unemployment and a loss in jobs, and a rise in the cost of living, and in general, just a bad policy standpoint. The important thing to notice here is that whilst Ofir Katz is doing this, and whilst other members are doing this from Shas and from other parties, they are essentially left-wing parties. They always have been, but they like to have this pretense of calling themselves on the right and saying the Likud calls itself, we are a right-wing party to free market and to capitalism. They're not. They never have been. The only time they ever have been was when Benjamin Netanyahu was an amazing Treasury Secretary, but that was in 2003. And since then, they have not done anything really that is a right-wing initiative. They had power for years, and yet some of their moves, they haven't come close to most of the reforms that this government is doing that are on the right wing of economics, which, to state, we'll discuss hopefully next week, have some major issues with them, and we'll get to what that means. But this is just to go and to point out this is a very bad economic decision, and B, just to point the hypocrisy of calling yourself a right wing when you're honestly just a populist. You just think that this is what the people want because the people don't understand economics enough to know that this will hurt them, and it's just not good enough. You cannot call yourself a right wing member when you do something like this.
So I don't want to get into the deep debate on the question of raising minimum wage and how that affects unemployment. There are many, many debates in the factor, but the one thing that is accepted is that this is exactly the question of right-wing economics and left-wing economics. And it's okay for you to support raising the minimum wage. It's a legitimate opinion of the left-wing economic view. So the thing that bothers you the most is that if you decide as a politician that you are supporting raising the minimum wage, that is totally fine. say, I'm supporting a left-wing economic view of raising the minimum wage. Just don't fool anyone that you're on the right wing, whether or not the decision is good.
So I agree with that, essentially. And I just want to add that first, we didn't really delve into the major issues with raising the minimum wage. If you want us to delve into this in the future, we're happy to. Just write into us. But just for one piece of for you to think about before we go out, when they say 40 shekel an hour, just respond with why 40? Why not 50? Why not 60? What is the arbitrary rule of 40? And when will that change to being 70 shekel an hour as the minimum wage?
And with that, we will conclude this week's episode. We thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed. We remind you to share this episode with your friends and family. And if you have any questions or topics you'd like to discuss, please email us at hwga.pod@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week. This is Here We Go Again.